stunned silence.
Oh, yes.
A bit of an episode, right?
So it must be doing something, right?
And it's playing its play or something.
Tell us what you really think.
I just can't think of it.
I love the enthusiasm.
Cool.
You're tuned to 15 Station, New Zealand's first cafe podcast. This is episode 119 for September 2017. I'm your host, James, and in the virtual rendition studios tonight, we've got Gavin. How are you, Gavin?
Good, thanks, James. Nice to talk to you as we venture into our 11th year of podcasting.
Oh, that's right, into our 11th year, and I've tried to tweak a few things with the audio this time, so I hope things are a bit better than our 10th anniversary episode from last month. Apologies to everyone for that one. And we're also always, always glad to welcome back Anna. How are you, Anna?
I'm well, thank you, James.
Thank you for joining us. It's a fantastic talk to you both. How is everything going? We're into spring. Spring as a season has sprung, and I heard today that it was up to like 35 degrees in Sydney, Gavin.
Yes, pretty much. So pretty warm for this time. I think the hottest September day ever. So we do like to set records apparently in Sydney on the weather. I think it was the driest and warmest winter ever. So we might talk about that a little bit later, I think.
But I think we will.
Spring has certainly arrived, at least for 2 days, and then we go back to actually summer's arrived for 2 days. We're about to go back to spring tomorrow. So,
well, there you go.
All good,
and good where you are as well, Anna.
Well, it's nice to have a bit of sunshine today.
Yes, it was.
Always welcome.
Yes.
And
yes.
A little bit warmer.
It was a little warmer. And speaking of warmer, you know, it's warming up as the polls right now because New Zealand is obviously heading into our general election in just a couple of weeks' time. So we're getting a lot of politics on the podcast this month. Well, you know, one story at least. This is from The Guardian. Jacinda Ardern has said that Labour will decriminalise abortion in New Zealand if it wins this month's general election. In a fiery 90-minute televised leaders' debate, Ardern stated unequivocally that abortion shouldn't be in the Crimes Act. Her stance was met with a round of applause and cheering from the 400-strong studio audience of undecided voters. Quote, people need to be able to make their own decisions, said Ardern. I accept there will be people out there who disagree with abortion, and I want them to have that as their right. But I also want women who want access to have it as their right too. This is about everyone being able to make their own decision, end quote. Under New Zealand law, abortion is a crime and legal only in cases of incest, mental subnormality, in quotes, or fetal abnormality, or where the physical or mental health of the mother would be seriously impacted by having a child. Other factors that may be taken into consideration but are not grounds in themselves include sexual violation and extremes of age. Prime Minister and National Leader Bill English, who is a practicing Catholic, said he thought the status quo was broadly satisfactory. Quote, if the changes came before Parliament, I would be opposed to liberalising the law, said English, to silence from the audience. I support the current law and I would not set out to change it. Yes, well, did you watch the debate? Gavin, have you been following things from Australia? Have you been sort of watching some of the debates?
I've been watching some of them. I didn't actually see this one, but obviously it generated a lot of headlines for the reasons that you've just so eloquently read there, James. And interesting that the Guardian felt the need to make sure that those who didn't get a chance to watch it themselves knew when the applause came and when there was deathly silence.
I thought that was very generous of them. I actually did watch
the subtle.
I watched the debate. It's the first leaders' debate I've watched in a long time. And for listeners, well, for all our Kiwi listeners, none of this is really news, but for our international listeners, the general election has turned into quite a competition, which no one was really expecting. Labour, a National, who are the current government, or the largest party in the current coalition government, would be going into their fourth term, Gavin? Yes.
If they win, they're going to their fourth.
Yeah.
Yep.
And everyone was kind of saying it was a bit boring, I think, wasn't it, Anna? It was just a bit boring. It was kind of, you know, Bill English on the National side and then Andrew Little was on the Labour side. Well, they went through two or three sort of leaders sort of following the Australian model, it looked like. And it was all a bit boring, really. And then Jacinda Ardern, who is mid to late 30s, you know, very, very sort of passionate speaker, very good communicator, gets elevated to the leadership, and suddenly the Labour takes off in the polls. So it's made for quite a interesting few weeks. But I guess the thing that I found interesting about watching the actual debate, and you know, our listeners can go check it out if they want to, I'm sure it's available online, was the part that, for a start, that this topic even came up. to sort of talk about moral issues, in light of everything else they were covering, I was quite surprised. To hear her response, she was unequivocal. I'll agree with the Guardian on that. And she did definitely get a round of applause behind her, which again isn't that surprising. But Gavin, it's quite a, I mean, to hold that position on what has been traditionally seen as a conscience issue inside the Parliament, what did you think that was about? Was that about her trying to win a certain section of the vote, or just took the opportunity to answer the question honestly?
Well, I don't think it would surprise anybody that Jacinda Ardern would have this view, and particularly Labour leaders have probably held this. You know, she's certainly a protege of Helen Clark, who would certainly have been somebody who would support anything that would make abortion easier for women to obtain. But having said that, she didn't change the abortion laws while she was in power. She may not have had the numbers to do so, but best of my knowledge, I don't think she actually sought to try and uprise them, because I think that what Bill English said, who is a Catholic, and some people would say, well, he should be trying to stop abortions from happening at all. He's taken a fairly, what some would call, pragmatic view, that the way the current system works seems to be allowing women who seek terminations to access them, and there are certainly some questions about whether the restrictions that you outlined, James, are being well adhered to. But what we do know is that the abortion rate in New Zealand has been declining, in terms of the surgical abortions at least. There are the statistics around those who are using medication to bring about abortion are less clear. But the euthanasia has been a big topic, and we've spoken about that on the podcast a couple of times, I think, in the last few months. So it was interesting to see another social issue become quite an important part of the debate landscape. And I think, in a sense, it was just the two sides stating where they land on this issue. I think it would be a conscience vote, regardless. So while she has said Labour will decriminalise it, I'm sure there would be some people in Labour who would ensure that they were able to vote with their conscience on an issue like this going forward, despite those comments.
I did find, and I guess I kind of opened myself up to this, I figured, okay, it's 2017, so if I'm going to actually watch the leaders' debate, which was just happenstance, actually, I managed to be home and my wife was out, and I was like, oh, well, what's on the old TV? And there we go, is the leaders' debate. But I figured, hey, it's 2017, I should second screen this. So I opened up, had my iPad there, and I had Twitter running, just to sort of see what the Twitterverse was saying as the debate was happening. And as I say, I probably opened myself up to it, but I was quite taken aback, I don't know why I should be, with the level of vitriol and emotion that was being expressed by some people on the Twitters. And on the euthanasia discussion most recently, with Simon O'Connor coming out with a position that has had him absolutely just ripped apart on Facebook, and there's just no, it seems from this, there's no room for logic. Like, if you look at what Ardern's saying there, where she says, I want them to have the right, and I want women to have who want access to have it as a right, it's about everyone being able to make their own decision. So the obvious thing for me is, yeah, but what about the unborn baby? What about the fetus? That doesn't seem to have a decision in this discussion. But you can't bring that up, because that would be talking logic, and this isn't a logical discussion.
Well, I think there's a question too. Like, are women wanting an abortion and not able to get it? And I don't think that actually happens in this country.
Well, I see something that suggested that there are a small number, albeit.
Yeah,
I think it was the first time I'd ever seen numbers like that.
I can't imagine that there would be a lot of people who would fall into that category, because the whole idea of this, of the mental health of the mother, danger to that, like, can be easily sort of twisted in your favor. So I mean, pretty much what we have is abortion on demand, and but what we do have are safeguards in the sense of who does them, I suppose, and also when during the pregnancy they can happen. And I think she's going to open a can of worms if she sort of And I think perhaps since then she's come and said, oh, well, yeah, well, there would have to be restrictions and things like that. But her sort of initial thing was just a wide open free for all,
yeah,
you know, like if
yeah.
someone wants to make a decision and a choice about abortion, when and where and who and all that kind of stuff, that they should be, you know, there should be no restriction on that. But in fact, I think she has come back later and said, yes, well, you know, would have to have restrictions or, you know, things in place that I just think it was a good thing in the sense that it does tell us where she's at and what she's thinking. And so that means that, like, for me personally as a voter, that means that I'm definitely not going to vote for her, but I'm clear and I understand that, and she's not sort of being deceptive about it, so that's a good thing. But yeah, I think she possibly needs to think through that that idea a little bit more. It might have bad complications.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a really good point, and I saw a couple of articles linking to one of the abortion advocacy groups in New Zealand and how their policy, where I think, I mean, they're obviously the extreme position where it's abortion should be allowed right up to the point of, you know, point of birth, which I've always found that concept just staggering. And reading through some of the comments, you know, you see people go, oh, it's just a clump of cells at that point. And I wanted to go, you're a clump of cells, because I mean, basically that's all we are.
Yeah.
And you're starting to cast an arbitrary point and say, okay, at this point it's not okay, and this point it is, along the period of pregnancy. And you kind of look at that and go, I just don't get the logic of it. So I do get, and I absolutely understand, that there are situations where pregnancy is unwanted, which is undesired, and those are two different things. Which are situations where it's medically dangerous. I get that those complications. So there are situations where abortions are seen from the average person to be a necessity or an outcome that they're after. Yeah, I get that, but I think you have to be, if you're following the logic, you have to at that point say, you know what, I'm actually going to value one life over another, which then, you know, you can I could respect that argument from a logical standpoint, that what you're saying is that the life of the mother actually counts for more than the life of the unborn child. I don't agree with that, but I can understand where you would come from. To try and say, but it's not a life yet, or it's not a, you know, it's an embryo, it's a fetus, it, you know, use this kind of language, particularly if you're holding an extreme position that says partial birth abortion's okay, like, it's the lack of logic that I'm struggling with here, going, well, how do I respect your argument if you don't actually base it on some sense of logic?
Well, the term fetus itself is a term that describes a growing thing, organism, you know, like it might be of another kind of animal or whatever, but a fetus is a term for a baby something.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, and the thing is that I don't suppose that at any time a fetus in a human being or in a woman has been anything other than a human fetus. So, you know, we're not going to find an elephant or a monkey even in there. It's always going to be a human fetus, so therefore it's always going to it is a baby. Like, scientifically it is, there's it's unscientific to say it's a bunch of cells in some respect. So
speaking of logic, James, I don't know whether you or our listeners might have seen the interview that James Franco did that was sort of doing the rounds on the internet a few weeks ago
with the eye roll.
Yeah, with the was she from Princeton maybe, or one of the Ivy League universities, and I don't know what the absolute opposite of logic is, but this professor was displaying it, trying to explain why abortion is morally fine.
The summary I saw was that the argument was that if the baby when born was going to go on to a life that was not worth living, then it may as well not be born at all.
Well, I think it was even weirder than that.
Yeah, it was.
If the mother chooses to abort the child, that child therefore had no future. So therefore, there's no immorality in the act. Is that your understanding, Anna? Am I reflecting that correctly?
It was almost like, and perhaps I haven't looked at it recently, but it was almost like because the mother doesn't want it, it's actually not a human being.
Oh, right.
Yeah, it has no value.
Or it has no worth.
It only basically has worth and has a life worth living if the mother wants it.
Regardless of whether the mother's rich or poor or, you know, how the child would live.
It's astonishing for me that we've come to a point where we've had to update the Hippocratic Oath to say, do no harm, I'll accept for that bit of harm, that kind of harm's okay. We've got to a point where, so the Simon O'Connor thing, for those who didn't see that, who's an MP who was commenting on Jacinda Ardern's position on euthanasia, how she was commenting on youth suicide commentary around how obviously the stats in New Zealand, which are absolutely shameful, one of the highest in the world, and that we need to do more about the mental health of teenagers and or people and Kiwis in general. Actually, it's not just the teenagers. We need to be doing more about mental health in New Zealand, which, again, can I just say, Jacinda, I totally agree with. Totally agree that we need to be doing more there. Simon O'Connor's point was, isn't that incongruent at a logical level to say that suicide is wrong, but assisted suicide is okay, because Jacinda Ardern and some of the others in Labour are quite pro-euthanasia. And of course, just gets totally savaged, like I've never seen it before, where the emotive response that people were coming back to is going, those two things are totally different. And his point was, well, no, it's the early ending of life, a purpose to end of life, to end suffering of one kind or another. And people going, no, one is the person's going to die anyway because it's terminal illness, and this is just ending their suffering. And the other is, you know, curable, people need to be supported, it's a failure of the system. And I was reading through some of these comments, and I just had to like stop myself from picking up the keyboard and going, but no, hang on, he's putting a logical argument. Now, what you can do is you can say, I am justifying the ability to end your life in this situation, right? You can justify that by saying, I think that in these situations, actually pros and cons, it stacks up, and in my opinion and my beliefs, I believe that this is okay. And then we can have a debate about it around saying, well, actually, well, I don't think it's okay because I'm more black and white or whatever else. But to say that they're not the same thing and to just play the man, not the ball, is exactly the same sort of stuff I've seen happening around this argument. I'm not undermining Jacinda Ardern for holding the position that she holds. I'm questioning that this whole... and I guess we're into a bigger, broader topic here around how abortion's become this women's rights thing. And it's almost diabolical the way that that's happened, to make it about choice and to make it about rising up against oppression and things like, when it's not that. It's not that. Mm. And as I said, I've said on the podcast before, I'll say it again, I am very pro-choice. I am pro-women having the choice with whom and when they have sex. That is the thing we should be focusing on. So, you know, we should not be... Rape, incest, these kind of situations should not be situations that women find themselves in. That's what we should be eliminating. But once you make the choice... This is a consequence of choice. The pregnancy is a consequence. It's not a choice in and of itself. So that's where Jacinda and I probably differ. Let's put it that way.
I feel like I've heard you say that before.
I have. I say it every time abortion comes up because I think the logic holds.
Maybe that's where I've heard it before.
Maybe.
On the show.
Have you heard this one before? This is from the Catholic News Agency. The Holy See has released a motu proprio. I can never pronounce that. Motu proprio from Pope Francis, outlining a shift in the responsibility of local bishops and the Apostolic See for the revision and approval of liturgical texts. Dated September 3rd, the document is titled Magnum Principum, meaning the Great Principle, and deals explicitly with two specific changes to Canon 838 of the Code of Canon Law, which of course we all know addresses the authority of the Apostolic See and National Episcopal Conferences in preparing liturgical texts in vernacular language. The document...
Clearly.
I mean, I know you guys knew that. I don't even know why I needed to bother expanding on what Canon 838 was about. The document was published on September 9 in the middle of Pope Francis's 6-day trip to Colombia, where he had that little that little bang with the Pope Mobile and hurt his head. And we hope he's healing well. Specifically, changes were introduced were to paragraphs 2 and 3 of Canon 838, Gavin, not what you thought, which was, you thought it was paragraph.
I thought it was going to be paragraph 1.
No, but it's paragraphs 2 and 3. So Canon 838.2 has until now stated that it is for the Apostolic See to order the sacred liturgy of the Universal Church, publish liturgical books, and review their translations in vernacular languages, and exercise vigilance that liturgical regulations are observed faithfully everywhere. Okay?
Yes.
Everyone got that? So
It's like the Pledge of Allegiance. You just remember it and everyone recites it all the time.
Yeah, that's right. However, with Francis's motu proprio, the text has been changed to read, it is for the Apostolic See to order the sacred liturgy of the Universal Church, publish liturgical books, recognize adaptations approved by the Episcopal Conference according to the norm of law, and exercise vigilance and liturgical regulations are observed faithfully everywhere. Okay? Everyone with me so far? Then in 838 paragraph 3, it previously read, it pertains to the conferences of bishops to prepare and publish, after the prior review of the Holy See, translations of liturgical books in vernacular languages, adapted appropriately within the limits defined in the liturgical books themselves. But the text will now read, it pertains to the Episcopal conferences to faithfully prepare versions of the liturgical books in vernacular language suitably accommodated within defined limits, and to approve and publish the liturgical books for the regions for which they are responsible after the confirmation of the Apostolic See. Right? So the changes apportion a greater portion of responsibility for the preparation and approval of the liturgical translations to Episcopal conferences, rather than the Vatican's Congregation for Divine Worship and the Sacraments. Additionally, Pope Francis noted that after the Second Vatican Council, the Church was acutely aware of the attendant sacrifice involved in the partial loss of liturgical Latin, which had been in use throughout the world over the course of centuries. However, it willingly opened the door so that vernacular liturgical translations, as part of the rites themselves, might become the voice of the Church, celebrating the divine mysteries along with the Latin language. Well, everyone followed all that. I know that you've got your well-thumbed copy of the canon law right in front of you, Anna. But did you have any initial thoughts on what the Holy Father's motu proprio was doing? Do you think this is a good idea, bad idea, or you're indifferent?
So I've never studied canon law.
What?
In all my theological study.
Seriously?
Well, yeah, it just never worked out.
That's the reason we got you on the podcast, because we thought you were a canon lawyer.
Oh, is that right? Look, I've seen various reactions to this, and you know, some people totally excited that now the bishops are just going to run rampant over our liturgical rites, certainly the language of our liturgical rites, and it's going to, you know, the current translation we have is going to be thrown out, and this is great. And then the opposite, where people are now sort of quite worried that we're going to have rogue liturgies and things like that. Look, I mean, the role of the bishop in liturgical matters, like, they have an important role, and I don't think that this should be a cause for concern. I mean, it's still quite clear that, you know, that what the bishops do, they still have to remain faithful to the Universal Church, and the Apostolic See still has oversight, you know, with, like, they can't just decide to do something completely random. And it just, you know, I don't think it's a bad thing what he's done anyway. And we have rogue bishops now, I suppose. Am I allowed to say that? And we have,
yes,
you know, some crazy liturgical practice going on. So, you know, that's not faithful to what's in the books anyway. So, you know, I don't think it's going to be much of a change in the sense of what is happening day to day in parishes. Perhaps actually it might have the benefit of speeding up the process of getting those new translations out, because they're not having to go backwards and forwards and to the various groups that need to tick it off, basically, and perhaps there'll be less conflict over minuscule little translations. So, I mean, we've been waiting for a translation for the Rite of Marriage for a very long time. And, it, you know, that still hasn't come out. And, well, yeah, it's just about to come out, hopefully. You know, so perhaps that's actually a benefit, so that a bishop's conference can actually, once they have a translation and it's a good translation, you know, that can actually, the publishing of it can actually get done. So we're not waiting 20 years or a decade at least for a new translation.
I think it's a very pragmatic approach. I like where you've come from with that, Anna. That sort of makes a lot of sense. Gavin, your thoughts? not implying that they'll be contrary to that, but your thoughts about what the pros and cons of the motu proprio would be?
Well, I might just go somewhere else on it. Well, just thinking a little bit as Anna was talking about her last story, now in some ways, not to equate liturgy with social issues like abortion or euthanasia, but liturgy in the church in so many ways is a bit of a hot button issue. So it did lead to, as Anna mentioned, there's been a range of reactions and stories out there. So some of the news agencies were saying, oh, you know, here's the Pope again sort of getting with the modern age and, you know, allowing a liberalization of the liturgy, and it's about time, and thank goodness someone did that. That whole clunky translation that particularly those English folks have had to put up with for the last few years will finally be able to be fixed. And it does create a serious level of angst amongst people who, in that case, if people are saying those things, people who seek to retain the sort of more traditional liturgical practices, and then similarly those people who are expressing outrage on the other side, comes back with there. So it is probably not a great analogy, but it is an issue that within church circles at least can cause a lot of distress amongst the faithful. So I don't pretend to be an expert on areas liturgical or canonical for that matter. So what I will say is listen to what Anna said.
Well,
just replay it again if you want. If you want to,
you can rewind a little bit and play it back as much as you like. Yeah, no, I think it's a good point. I do think the question that I would sort of ask is how much does that translation, so speeding the translation up of things that we are still waiting for, I totally get. There is a part of me that still, when I look at, I've never understood what the big issue is with the most recent translation. I understand some of the challenges that people have because they don't like what the underpinning of, like the for many instead of for all. And I remember my dad having a conversation with me about how he didn't like the enter under my roof. And his comment was, oh, we're not under a roof. And I'm like, but Dad, it's actually great we are under a roof, and plus it's metaphorical, but more than that, it's liturgical, it's scriptural. You know, coming from, yeah. And I like that direct tie to scripture, that's nice. The consubstantial, yeah. Everyone freaking out about what consubstantial meant and all, it's so complicated. But I, you know, the thing about it for me that I would just sort of hope that this motu proprio helps with, I don't know how it would, or at least doesn't go away from, is there are some aspects of modern liturgy which just feel dated. And that is I think it's ironic, because I am part of a faith that's at least, you know, well, it's been there since the dawn of time, really, but particularly since the institution of the Eucharist, 2,000 years old. So to say something feels dated, you would think people would go, well, obviously it feels dated, James, it's 2,000 years old. But no, it doesn't feel 2,000 years old. It feels 40 to 50 years old. It feels like some of the language that's sort of crept in the translation, some of the songs that are sung, some of the stuff that we're seeing, just feels very retro, and not in a good way. It's sort of like, you know, the jeans aren't cool enough to be vintage. They're just a bit old and daggy. And I look at that and go, if this is going to allow more of that, I'm not a fan. If this is going to allow for less of that and cleaner and more pure liturgy and liturgical words, fantastic. But on the face of it, I don't know. I don't know if I want it, you know, and translated into the vernacular, particularly as the vernacular gets worse and worse if you look at what modern language is actually about.
I might have one thing to add.
Go on.
Actually, now that I think about it.
Good thing we've got you on the podcast.
Good idea. Thinking about one of the things that we find, well, many of us find particularly comforting or a source of strength, I guess, within the church is the consistency of liturgy, particularly as we travel around the English-speaking world, but it's the same in other languages. We just don't understand it necessarily. So one of the things that I had thought about and forgot, now I've remembered, was that idea that if, particularly for those of us who sometimes travel between New Zealand and Australia or other parts of the world, that sense of comfort when you go and sort of, oh yeah, this is familiar. And again, that a sense of, is there a potential that that's lost in this? Anna and I think that story would suggest that maybe people who fear that, they won't have their fears realized. But it was just in the thought that came to me that I like that sort of normality or that consistency that we enjoy across the liturgy in different countries.
That might happen. That might be a consequence. I think one of the things we forget is that, you know, we've only been using the vernacular for, you know, since 1969. And like when Latin and even Greek became the languages of scripture and of the liturgy, there was centuries of developing those languages into languages, sacred languages, so languages that spoke of the sacred. So, you know, the Latin that they used in the liturgy, like there's a difference between classical Latin and ecclesial Latin. So there was a particular Latin that was developed that was used in the liturgy and in theological texts and things like that. So what we have to try and do is, and so in some ways we actually have to be really patient with our translations, and it's good to have time with them and to pray with them, and, you know, we're never going to arrive at a perfect translation, but we have to somehow develop a way in which we can use English, or our language, to talk about what's sacred, to talk about the mysteries of God. And that should be our focus. Like, how can we use this language to express those great mysteries of Christ, instead of how do we, sort of dumb it down or not dumb it down, make it too sort of the type of language that no one can understand. So, but this takes time, and you know, we've only got a few decades under our belt, and you know, maybe in a couple of centuries, that's when we can kind of start going, wow, maybe we've arrived somewhere.
I'll look forward to that.
Yeah. But I think that's it. You know, some people are upset about this current translation, and it is quite different from the previous translation. Like, it used different principles. And not everyone's happy with it. But it's not going to be perfect, and I don't think anyone says that it is. But it's attempting something. It's attempting to encompass the mysteries of our faith, and we shouldn't take that lightly, and so it's kind of something we'll keep working on. Our liturgy is growing and changing and developing, and it should be forever new, so hopefully those dated parts, you know, like that's a you know, it should be forever new, somehow we have to keep that going in our liturgical development, not base it on particular political ideologies or whatever.
Well, that's often. Absolutely. I echo Gavin's previous statements. Just go back and listen to what Anna said. Let's just do that. I would like to join my voice to yours, Anna, on that. And in doing so, I am following something that's happening from, this is from Reuters, Pope Francis and Orthodox Christian leader Patriarch Bartholomew joined their voices and called on Friday for a collective response from world leaders to climate change, saying the planet was deteriorating and vulnerable people were the first to be affected. The appeal comes 3 months after US President Donald Trump withdrew from a global agreement struck in Paris to limit greenhouse gas emissions. Quote, "We urgently appeal to those in positions of social and economic, as well as political and cultural, responsibility to hear the cry of the earth and to attend to the needs of the marginalised, Francis and Bartholomew said in a joint statement. Above all, the leaders of the world's 1.2 billion Catholics and up to 300 million Orthodox Christians asked for a response to the plea of millions and support for the consensus of the world for the healing of our wounded creation. The joint message was not addressed to any specific world leaders. Many were dismayed when the US backed out of the Paris Accord, a decision a senior Vatican official later called a disaster. Don, what do you think? We haven't got Don, unfortunately. So
that's the greatest moment in 119 episodes. So, bar none.
If Don was on the podcast, I could have a pretty good guess about some of the stuff he's going to say. But before I try and do my best Don impression, Gavin, what did you make of the Pope and the Patriarch, the Eastern Patriarch, and their call here for a collective response from world leaders?
Well, I was going to try and do my Don impersonation as well, but I'll leave it to you.
No, please, you go. I'm just trying to facilitate.
Well, no, I think there is a... using my own reaction first, I think it's a hugely important thing that the Pope and the Patriarch have gone out of their way to raise this issue again. And I don't think anyone... I'm certainly not a skeptic of climate change, but I'm also not an alarmist, and I'm not a denier, so I'm somewhere in the middle, probably like most people. But I don't think anyone can look at Harvey and Irma and a range of other weather events around, 35 degrees in September in Sydney, whatever it is. Climate is changing, there's no question about it, and there is no question that human involvement has something to do with that. So to say that we need to do more than we're currently doing, I think is to most people common sense, and when the Pope and the Patriarch choose to say it, people will naturally stand up and listen, and I think that's what's happened. Whether they will stand up and do anything is another question. So I commend them for saying things. And I do hold the view that Pope Francis can make his views on many, many issues at the same time, rather than having to sort of retain his focus on certain issues that some people would wish he would only speak about all the time. Looking at anyone in particular.
That was a terrible Don impersonation, can I say?
I didn't get to the Don impersonation part.
Anna, what did you make of these two leaders and their call to the collective leaders of the world?
I sort of in most part agree with what Gavin said, that this is a good thing. People listen to the Pope and Patriarch Bartholomew, love that name, and anything that looks after the environment, I'm all for. I'm probably a bit more skeptical about the whole human involvement in climate change, but we can, would be very happy for some practices, industrial practices and things like that to change. I don't want to drink poisoned water, and I want to eat fresh fruit and vegetables, and I'd hope that everyone across the world could have that possibility. I guess somehow connecting it with the Paris Accord, I mean, I'm not convinced at all that the Paris Accord is actually something that's helpful, but more can be done, but whether it's via the protocols of the Paris Accord, I'm not really entirely convinced of that. In general, I'm all for it.
I think that's that was also a terrible Don impersonation. So I think what Don would say is, it's a shame that the Pope is talking about these matters when he could be talking about other matters. But I have to say, just to make this a podcast of agreement, that I agree with both of you, which for me, I look at this and go, you know what, Frank and Bart, it's to be terrible if they call that, Pope Frank and Patriarch Bart. So Francis and Bartholomew have got far better words. It's good for them to be using their positions, I think, to try and influence policy around the world. And I also agree with you, Gavin, that there's no reason why they shouldn't be doing that on a number of different issues. And I think they do that on a number of different issues. They don't have, you know, a huge amount of say over which ones get picked up by the media and which ones don't. But I do look at this and go,
yeah.
You know, I do look at this and go, this is important. The world is in a bit of a state. And whether or not you think the, you know, global climate change is attributable to humans or not, no one, back to my point around logic, no one could make a logical argument that says that humans are not damaging aspects of our environment. So that part has to be taken as fact. And anyone who says that it's not needs to seriously get their head read, right? The nature of our ability to seek out alternative sources of fuel, to look at opportunities for how we reduce waste, to look at opportunities for how we reduce chemical and pollutants and things like that into the ecosystem. That stuff should absolutely be what every nation should be geared towards, because the planet should be able to support a lot more life than it does today. I mean, social inequality comes into that, economic inequality comes into that, and you've got to say environmental damage comes into that. Then you get...
Yeah, and I think it's...
Go on, mate.
Sorry.
No, you go.
And I think it's important what's said in there about the vulnerable and marginalised being the first to suffer from a range of things that you mentioned there. But, we here in the Pacific, we can look to some of the places up in remote Pacific islands and atolls that are, again, climate's changing, and we can talk about the causes of it, but certainly ocean levels are rising in places like Kiribati, where people are sort of already struggling to have much of an existence anyway.
Yeah.
And probably in, if recent trends continue, in 5 to 10 years, some of those places will be completely underwater. And what are countries like New Zealand, Australia, or other relatively wealthy countries doing to think about who are the environmental victims of the changing climate? And just to the point you made, James, before about the idea that Pope Francis and Patriarch Bartholomew and other bishops and church leaders and any other people who have a voice of some influence, that concept that, they never say anything about X or they never say anything about Y. And actually, they often do. And the media don't report it. And that doesn't mean the same... That's not the same thing as... they say nothing. For example, the same-sex marriage debate is raging in Australia at the moment, and we thankfully didn't talk about it today because it's dominating so much of everything else in Australia. But you hear people say, I wish the Catholic bishops would say as much about the refugees that are and being held in detention centres in the Pacific as they did about same-sex marriage. And well actually, if you went and actually looked at source documents, you'd probably find they're saying a lot you would find that they are saying a lot about the injustice there, and about, I've just put out a statement about the economy and how the economy is not doing enough to support people who are vulnerable and marginalised. Yet I've yet to see a mainstream newspaper report on that. Yet there's plenty of stuff. If you say one thing, one comment about same-sex marriage, it's front page news. So like others, Pope Francis speaks on a range of issues. Some of them get reported and many of them don't. This is the age of consumption, media consumption, that we live in. And you can make the argument that people should cut out the middleman and just go to the Vatican website.
I was
going to
say
everything the Pope has said.
I was going to say you can actually for free.
But you might see some parchment.
Parchment. I'm pretty sure, if I just quickly check, that the Vatican.
I think they have updated
the site. Yeah. The thing I would say is that it's quite important to recognise the need to that you can actually access this information for free in the internet. Just go use Google. They still got a bit of parchment on the Vatican side. it's a bit nicer now. Yes, absolutely. So I think it's one of those things where it's something where it's constantly we need to be constantly reminded about it. We need to be reminded about it politically, socially, culturally, religiously, spiritually, all of the elites, because we need to start doing stuff differently. And if it just means a few million people start to change their behaviours on the back of the fact that the two spiritual leaders are telling them that it's a good idea to do so, then I think that's a good thing. Then maybe we can change the face of the world for the positive. Speaking of changing faces, this is from the Associated Press. The share of Americans who identify as white and Christian has dropped below 50%, a transformation fueled by immigration and by growing numbers of people who reject organized religion altogether, according to a new survey just released. Christians overall remain a large majority in the US at nearly 70% of Americans. Wow, that's high. However, so-called white Christians, once predominant in the country's religious life, now comprise only 43% of the population, according to the Public Religion Research Institute, or PRRI, a polling organization based in Washington. Four decades ago, about 8 in 10 Americans were identified as white Christians. Do you know what I mean? It's weird, don't you think, they're saying white Christians, but was it just me? It just sort of sounds like different. Well, okay. I think everyone knows what they
mean. Well, New Zealand.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
The change has occurred across a spectrum of Christian traditions in the US, including sharp drops in membership in predominantly white mainline Protestant denominations, such as Presbyterian and Lutherans, an increasing Latino presence in the Roman Catholic Church as some non-Hispanic white Catholics leave, and shrinking ranks of white evangelicals, who until recently have been viewed as immune to decline. The trends identified in the survey are fueling anxiety about the place of Christians in society, especially among evangelicals, alarmed by support for gay marriage and by the increasing share of Americans, about one quarter, who don't identify with a faith group. Well, it's good to know the Associated Press has been able to figure out that it's fueling anxiety. That's I'm glad that the investigative journalism has proved that out. Interesting though, these numbers. So it's a bit of a change in, you know, the title, the headline there, Anna, about the changing face of Christianity in the US. What did you make of these sort of stats? I mean, did any of them jump out and surprise you, or were you like, that's pretty much what I would have expected?
To be fair, I haven't really spent much time thinking how many the percentage
really?
Of
you haven't?
There are in America. It's interesting information, I suppose. Stats usually are. Like you, I kind of find the term white a bit...
it just feels weird.
Italian, Irish, Polish, like this is just...
Yeah.
Talk about sort of lump a particular group of people. And, you know, like that would actually be quite interesting to see whether different... nationalities, like those who identify as Irish American or Polish American or whatever, like whether there's changes amongst those, which obviously there would be. It's not a surprise. I think the white Western society perhaps is becoming progressively more unreligious, and so I'm not surprised by that.
No, it didn't really blow me away. They just put I guess we would sort of talk about New Zealand European, and that doesn't really gel with the Americans either. But Gavin, what did you say the European, because to imply that all Europeans are white is just is a fallacy. I guess if you did break down those demographics, that would be interesting to see where the country or cultural connection lies. I mean, we already know that. I don't think a single country in the European Union has a self-replacing birth rate at the moment. So, I mean, to see a rejection of or a fall away from church attendance probably isn't news. It's a day beginning with ending with the letter Y on, you know. But Gavin, what did you make of this particular report?
I do like a number or two, I'll say that. I don't mind a statistic. I thought the reason I included it in the show notes for us to talk about this time is because I think in the last several months we've spoken about the realities in Australia, and I think in New Zealand as well, in terms of this growing shift towards no religion, and that's obviously being seen in the US maybe in larger numbers than I might have expected, given that the time that I've spent in the States and sort of the general consensus is that the US has been a bit of a bulwark against sort of atheism or the rise of agnosticism and and some Western countries, but and not as much as maybe we thought. And again, seeing it, that idea of the changing face, as we've seen clearly in Catholic churches in Australia and New Zealand, and again, no doubt other places as well, in terms of the influence of Filipino and Indian and Chinese and Korean and other, mainly from Asia, but certainly from the Pacific as well, and the changing demographics in Catholic parishes in Australasia has been pretty marked, and we're seeing that's being replicated there in the US, largely from people from Latin America. I was at a talk recently, actually. Again, I don't mind a statistic. And I went to because I have a real problem with this, went to listen to some demographers and statisticians talk about changing face of world religions.
You know how to have a...
In my spare time. And they're actually looking at the demographics around those who do... So this is an international survey of surveys, if you will, from the Pew Research Center in the US, which is sort of the gold standard in many ways of religious surveying and research, and showing that we often think about those having no religion as being sort of, oh, those are the 18 to 34s. You know, this is this whole evolution of, you know, young people don't embrace religion, and therefore this is just going to extrapolate itself over the next generation or two, and before you know it, religion's going to be dead. Well, this person from Pew was saying, actually, the average age of people who state no religion across the world is actually much higher than those of most other religions. So that sense that that's the inevitability doesn't appear to be the case based on their projections about how things are going to go, based on ages and birth rates and some of those sorts of things, because often those who have no religion, for a range of factors, might choose not to have as many children. And some of the large Eastern religions have larger families, not to mention some of the Christian religions. So actually there's going to be a continuing growth in the number of people who are religious globally, but what we're seeing in the English-speaking world largely is a push the other way. So we can often lament and say, oh, you know, the end is nigh and Christianity is dying, but Christianity and certainly Hinduism and Islam and Buddhism and some of the big Eastern religions are continue to grow, and the experts suggest that there's no sign of that slowing down.
Well, it's
so just some fun facts.
Some fun facts, man. I'll tell you what, I was awake through the whole thing. No, just, yes, I do find it funny that you were willing to admit your serious nerdism there on your data and your facts and your stats. But I do think that
I have a problem.
I do think it is the point that you raise around the assumption that a lot of people make, that the no religion is just the, you know, just the youth or just the, you know, kids these days kind of thing, when it's far more complicated than that, is a really good one. I do think that the changing makeup of the church is a reality that we are having to steer into, and what has historically been something which, you know, it's not news really in New Zealand because it's been happening for so long, because the demographic of New Zealand is changing, the demography. But it's one of those things where it's interesting to see, and I see what the Americans are making of it. Our last story comes from the Pittsburgh Post Gazette. That well-known
one of my favourite,
that's right, absolutely, yes.
Yeah.
Josh Archibald is taking the spiritual experience of winning the Stanley Cup to a new level. The Penguins winger had his son Brecken. Is that a name, Brecken?
I reckon it is
baptised in the NHL's championship trophy during his day with it Wednesday in Brainerd. Because it looks like it's written brain nerd.
I left that in just for you.
Brainerd.
People didn't really need to know exactly where it was.
Yeah, Brainerd, Minnesota, I guess. Is that Minneapolis or Minnesota? Yeah.
Minnesota.
The Hockey Hall of Fame's Philip Pritchard captured the moment on Twitter. It's not the first time the cup has doubled as a baptismal font. Detroit's Thomas Holmstrom used it for that purpose after his Red Wings beat the Penguins in 2008. A short and sweet story to end, but that does crack me up. I have always thought the Stanley Cup is a bit of a ridiculous looking trophy. Like, you know, because they have to keep adding all... That's the one with the massive base that they keep adding rings to because they etch everyone, including the, you know, the guy who sweeps the ice onto the thing when they win each year. Is that the one?
Well, it's massive, I'll say that. It's very, very tall.
Yes.
And it's got a bowl that's large enough to baptize a baby, and we found that out twice. Yeah. That was probably my favourite part of the story. Like, I was like, wow, someone baptized their baby in the Stanley Cup. It was like, wow, someone else did that before that. He's not even the first person to do it. That was my favourite part of the story. That it's
It is one of those things where if you look at it, I'm just sort of looking at a photo of it on Wikipedia, and like it looks like they etch a lot of names into those bottom plates. Like they had to keep adding to it. Because
I don't know if the Zamboni guy gets his name on it, to be fair, but I suspect the whole, mate, it appears that the whole team might get their name on it. Yeah. I don't know. I'm not an expert in ice hockey,
The Stanley Cup is engraved with the names of the winning players, coaches, management, and club staff.
Okay, there you go.
There you go. Could be the Zamboni guy.
It could be the Zamboni driver as well, yeah.
I'm just saying. Anna, what do you make of this? You sort of sit there and go, that's a great way to welcome your child into the church.
This is what happens when you give bishops' conferences too much leeway.
Oh, man.
No, just joking.
Yes. It's, I mean, isn't it great?
Well, valid matter.
Yes, valid, that's a good point. Let's focus on that. Focus on the water.
It was a human baby, and there was water. Isn't that all we need?
Yep.
You're the expert.
And the formula. You need the formula, right? You need to be able to, you need to say it right. You need to say Father, Son,
Holy Spirit. Oh, yeah, Creator, Redeemer.
No.
Sanctifier.
No, you're not.
Only in extreme circumstances can you just use that very basic formula. Like, you know, if you... not in extreme circumstances. Well, certainly if it was going to be a Catholic baptism, I mean, might not have been.
Good point.
But
it is a child, you know, and I mean most infant baptism is kind of Catholic. And to be fair to them, you know, it's a pretty extreme situation. He only had it for a day. So, you know.
Exactly. So he's got the cup for an alternity. Yeah. Playing forever.
He's on
the bishop
clock.
Come along.
We're on the clock here, Father. Come on, let's go.
It'll be a claim to fame, I'm sure, but
it'll be a claim to something at least, yeah.
From the liturgical, not purist, but you know, person who wants it done well, it's none of, if I ever have children, they're not getting baptized in the Stanley Cup.
You heard it here.
Bledisloe Cup.
Yep, yeah, Bledisloe Cup.
Maybe the Bledisloe Cup.
That's huge.
That's
huge.
Yeah, and it has to be. I mean, when you look at the Stanley Cup, it is actually well designed to be, you know, the little cup on top, and it's a pedestal. It actually works. I can see it. I can see the photo. Well, that's the, you know, there's a first. After 119 episodes, there's a first. There's a first talking about a baptism in a Stanley Cup. But if you don't believe me, you can go back and listen to the other 118 episodes and see this is the first time we've talked about it. And you can find those episodes at our website, www.station15.co.nz. I don't know why I say www after all these years. You can just go station15.co.nz.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
I thought you were a guru.
You can't go to vatican.va. You have to go www2 or something, .vatican.va.
Yeah,
www2.vatican.va. If you want to reach out and let us know, to give us anything, really, give us any kind of feedback, any kind of thoughts, we're always glad to hear from you, our listeners. You can reach us at podcast@station15.co.nz, or you can reach us on the Twitters, twitter.com/station15, or facebook.com/station15 as well. Thank you very much, Anna. It's always great to talk to you. Thank you for, I know you had some important stuff on tonight, so to make the time to come and talk to us on the podcast, really appreciate it.
You're welcome, and we did win, so that's great.
That's great.
Yes!
In the netball, right? Yeah, there we go.
Yeah.
All our American listeners will now have to go look up what netball is. and Gavin, always good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you, James. It's my month is never complete without a Skype date with you.
Oh, aren't you sweet? Aren't you, eh? What a charmer. What a charmer. And that's why I guess our listeners keep coming back is... You know, come for the news, but stay for Gavin's charm. That should be our catchphrase. But thank you. Thank you all out there for listening. And until next month, take care and God bless.
God bless.
This production is affiliated with SQPN, the StarQuest Production Network, leading the way.